Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
Adam, on our show today, we have the great privilege of talking with Vivian Connell, teacher, lawyer, and advocate, about adversity, inspiration, and hope.
Well, and we're going to hear about each one of those because she's an amazing individual, Christine, and we're so privileged, as you said, to be able to have her on the show talking about her experiences with ALS, but what she's really doing with her life that defines things.
I'm so looking forward to that. But first, we do have some research that matters. We're going to talk about aspirin and prevention of cancer.
We're going to talk about exercise and its impact on fatty liver disease, and a good thing.
About chronic migraines and its toll on families.
And then we're going to talk about the genetics of mosquitoes, and Christy and I will come clean about our strategies.
Okay, let's first talk about aspirin. So we've talked about this on the show before, Adam, about various research pointing to some benefits to taking aspirin for heart problems, but also is its potential to reduce cancers.
Yes, and this is kind of more summary research that really is kind of honing in on potential benefit of aspirin use for one particular type of cancer, colon cancer, where there was a 20% lower risk of this among those who were taking aspirin a full strength at least twice a week. But that's not the end of the story.
No, and it was a big study. These were looking at over 82,000 women who were in that nurses' health study, and over 47,000 men enrolled also in a survey study, following them for about 32 years to see who developed cancer and how they had reported 30 years prior, you know, how much aspirin they took and how often they took it, and did find that the women and men who took regular doses of aspirin two times a week or more had this reduction in gastrointestinal cancers, including colon cancer, rectal cancer, and esophageal cancer.
And so one of the ways of understanding this is, okay, there well may be a benefit for colon cancer, esophageal cancer. So people are at really high risk, family histories of these types of cancers. Well, that's a really good conversation to have with your doctor. But what it doesn't tell us is perhaps for the other people who aren't at risk, how do you kind of weigh in taking the aspirin versus the possible side effects of aspirin use, which we have seen a lot, you and I and our colleagues, with bleeding and gastritis and inflammation of the stomach and irritation, and as well as the benefit maybe of other non-aspirin related ways to reduce colon cancer.
Exactly. So this is certainly not a message to everyone to go start taking aspirin every day, but it is to raise the question of, are you at higher risk for colon cancer or related cancer? Do you have heart disease or some other reason you should be taking an aspirin? And maybe this will make you feel good that it has potentially another benefit. And how to go ahead and raise that with your doctor at your general checkup or at your next follow-up appointment.
Speaking of your next follow-up appointment, we have an increasing number of patients throughout our healthcare system that have a really serious and difficult health condition called non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. So it's kind of advanced liver disease that's actually not due to alcohol use, but due to excessive fat around the liver, which is frequently associated with excess weight, obesity, and we haven't had a lot of good therapies. Tell us about this research, Christy.
Well, we've often focused on weight loss, which is appropriate, to help people try to improve some of this extra fatty aspect of their liver. Some people progress into a more significant liver disease, and some people can get better with weight loss. But this was looking to see, okay, if we tell people to exercise, how much exercise is really going to make a difference? So they took about 50 people, randomly divided them into all these different groups with different intensities of exercise, and found out that regardless of how much or how intense the exercise regimen, all of the groups who did exercise had, you know, somewhere between 18 and 29% improvement in the fatty liver disease.
And this was published in the Journal of Hepatology, and it really suggests
study of the liver.
But it sounds better if you say hepatology.
It does. It sounds so fancy.
Hepatology, which is a scary sort of thing when you have fatty liver disease and you are worried about, is your liver going to fail?
Right.
But this suggests that some aspects of this fatty liver disease can potentially be reversed with regular exercise and probably weight loss. It's probably not just enough to do the physical activity, but it's certainly a huge start. And boy, this gives you a little bit of hope and really adds that emphasis to let's work on weight loss, but let's also work on exercise.
Right. And not let it being something you have to do every day so hardcore be a barrier, but just get moving.
Yep.
Let's talk about our next research that matters. And this is about chronic migraines.
You ever had migraines, Christy?
I have had migraines. They've gotten much better in the last several years, but I have.
That's because you've been working with me on the
that's
show.
That's right. It's just therapeutic.
These things are true, true.
Just lowers
maybe
my migraines.
Unrelated. I have migraine headaches at times, and usually it's associated when I don't eat, I don't sleep, I'm pretty stressed, like maybe not taking care of myself. But a lot of people have migraines for lots of reasons, some of which are genetic, and they get headaches pretty much every day or at least, you know, 10, 15 times a month. And the question is this a family disease? Does this affect lots of people in the family? And intuitively, I'd say, yeah, it does. I know when my family gets something, it affects everyone.
Sure. And we know that there's an estimated 113 million workdays lost annually due to migraines in our nation, which is costly. And if people are missing work, surely that affects the family. But this was research looking at and published in the American Academy of Neurology at their annual meeting presented that involved more than 11,000 adults and asked people who have migraines how it affected their family life, finding that, in fact, it does affect their perception of their family life.
And, you know, it's like, okay, so what do we do with this? You know, there's so many diseases that perhaps do affect families, but, you know, a lot of times we, when we go to see the doctor, perhaps our family doesn't go with us, and we say, well, what did the doctor say? For this one, I think it's one of those things where I would say, why don't you perhaps bring your spouse in with you next time or significant other? And let's talk about this. Let's hear about this. And let's maybe come up some ways together we can be supportive. That's how it changes maybe what I do. I don't know if that'd be useful.
No, and I think it reinforces how important it is to have a multifaceted or multiple different angles that we're helping care for someone with chronic disease. In this case, it's chronic migraines, that it has to do with sleep and stress and exercise and family dynamics and all of these different things that are both affected by the illness and can potentially make the illness worse. And so by really partnering with people and families, as you're suggesting over time, that's I think where we'll see the most success.
Speaking about partnering with families, our last research that matter is about something near and dear to me and my family, which is mosquitoes. We do not like mosquitoes. No, we don't.
No, we don't. But they love me.
They kind of like me, but they like some people in my family even more, which is a real problem because it seems like you can go outside and two people sitting next to each other, one person gets 20 bites, the other person like almost gets none. Doesn't
tell me
seem
about
fair.
It. I know. That's my husband. He's like, what are you talking about? And I'm like, got welts all over my body. And it's me and my children. So this research kind of ties that together. We've learned before that there's some sort of hormone that some people's skin sends out that attracts mosquitoes or pheromones. You hear about those connections. But this is looking at like a real genetic, like in your genes, in your body component of what leads to this attraction to mosquitoes.
Yeah, this was in the journal Plus One, and they had 18 sets of identical female twins and 19 sets of non-identical female twins. And the ones that were identical were much more likely by putting their hands in a tube that was filled with 20 mosquitoes for getting lots of bite. Similarly, in those who were not identical twins, they were kind of different rates, meaning that perhaps it wasn't the same genetic thing that was causing it. Well, first off, I don't like putting my hands in mosquito jars, for the record.
I hope they paid them a lot.
I would not have been in this study. But it does suggest that there is a genetic trait here, whether some people have a natural, what's that chemical that you can burn? Citronella. Maybe some people have some sort of, way of putting out something that mosquitoes don't like. Maybe we can learn from that. Maybe we can do something about it. But in the meantime, if someone says, boy, mosquitoes like me, they probably do.
Yeah. And so, using mosquito, we talked about this before, but getting into DEET and some of those products, there are people like me who I couldn't make it through the season if I didn't use some of those chemicals to get through.
Yeah. I even like now have done something to spray the bushes. And I don't know, I feel guilty, I feel a little, maybe the listeners can give me a better way. I think it's the best of a bad situation. I don't like putting these stuff on me. I don't know, but boy, it scares me. I don't like it.
But I can't live with the welts all over my body either. But and it's worse when you see it on your kids. You feel like you've got to protect them. But
yeah, well, that'll conclude the research that matters. We've talked, and probably more than people want to hear, about mosquitoes. We've had a good chance to talk about the migraine and perhaps bringing in the family.
Talking about the importance of talking with your doctor if you're at high risk for colon cancer about whether or not you should take an aspirin.
And the benefits of exercise, especially for folks who maybe have exercise regressive conditions, things that can get better with exercise, like fatty liver disease.
Well, that does conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Vivian Connell, a teacher, lawyer, and advocate, about adversity, inspiration, and a story of hope. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're talking with Vivian Connell, teacher, lawyer, remarkable advocate, about adversity, inspiration, and hope. Welcome to Your Health, Vivian.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm really, really happy to be here.
And, you know, I must say that we only met a couple weeks ago, It was such a coincidence of life experiences, perhaps, where some good friends that I hadn't seen in 30 years wanted me to come out to hear about someone who was struggling with ALS, but yet doing such inspirational things. And then the following week, my rabbi said, after you run this half marathon, run on over to synagogue. There's this amazing woman. And he told me nothing else. And it was you.
What a neat connection.
It was amazing. And when your rabbi met me at the Monte, the storytelling venue, Jeff Polish, who runs that, said something of the same thing to the audience as he introduced me. He said, I'd never heard of this woman. Mike Ofalu, who was a judge I had met through law school, reached out and told me about her. And then this person and this person and this person, everything converged, and I ended up telling my story at the Monte. So this sort of
confluence.
Absolutely. The confluence of people who know each other and the connections has been really amazing to see since my diagnosis.
Well, speaking of your story, we would love to be able to share part of that with our listeners today. You're a teacher, a lawyer, an advocate. You're speaking in all these places that are intersecting. Yes. Tell us a little bit about your story.
Well, I guess the relevant part begins with the teaching. I had been teaching in various venues from Japan to Georgia and then the last 7 years in North Carolina when I became very frustrated with education policy. And I had an activism club and had really promoted civic engagement. And I thought, well, if I'm ever going to model that and have a second career, now's the time to do it. And so I left the classroom. You know, I think if you're going to try to influence public policy, you need to actually understand it. So I did go to law school. I had some trouble after I graduated in 2013 with my left leg, and I passed the bar and was admitted to the North Carolina bar in October while pursuing a diagnosis and then diagnosed with ALS in March of 2014. In the meantime, I had gone back to doing some ESL support teaching because it was very unusual to start the school year and not be teaching. So I was doing that, and that's sort of how this all got started.
And for our listeners, let's just let them know what ALS is. I think most people have heard of it. They know the ALS challenge that was out there.
Yes, the ice bucket.
And I also maybe let our listeners know you were diagnosed with something that you yourself had to learn about, and you needed to communicate or desire to communicate this to your friends and acquaintances.
Yes. So amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, I still have trouble pronouncing it, because it is easier to say ALS or, of course, Lou Gehrig's disease. And despite the ice bucket challenge, you'd be surprised how many people say, well, are you going to get better? And I'm like, no, it's degenerative and it's terminal. And they say, oh, but you're going to be around a long time. And I say, well, no, probably only 2 or 3 years. But I don't have to explain that too often because, as I think you're getting at, after I told close friends and family, I did decide to post for everyone else in a long Facebook post that ended up going viral and opening up all kinds of doors for me as far as fundraising and events and abilities to sort of serve the causes that I had gone to law school to promote.
What do you mean it went viral?
Well, it was a private post saying to everyone, listen, you know, I've been having health problems. I only want to do this once. It was really quite detailed about the prognosis, about the realities of the disease. I tried to let everyone know that I was okay, that my faith was sufficient, and what I intended to do, which was not to make my life about ALS or let it change my trajectory or my goals. And then I also wanted to empower people by telling them ways that they could help and causes they could serve. So I did this, and someone took the private post and sent it to a national education blogger, Diane Ravitch, who is a hero of mine. And she quite kindly, I just met her at an education national conference of the Network for Public Education in Austin about 8 days before I was diagnosed. And everyone was saying, you know, good luck, let us know. And she wrote a blog post entitled, Vivian Connell, Face of a Hero, which is hyperbole out the yang, I'll tell you that. But after that, things really came off the rails. And with the projects I had encouraged people to contribute to, I started doing media, and it just became a runaway train of activity and donations and
a good runaway train.
Mm-hmm. You know, at first, as I said in my story at the Monte, I was sort of mortified. I did not want to improve education or address campaign finance reform or promote public justice and public interest law by becoming terminally ill. That was not my goal. You know, that was never something I wanted to do. And when I became terminally ill, when I was diagnosed, I thought, well, I won't be able to do these things. But yes, it became a sort of venue for achieving the things that I had hoped to achieve in the first place. And that has been a sort of amazing, surreal blessing.
And thinking about that change of hearing that wasn't your goal as you set out right. to advocate and go to law school, and right. then you received this diagnosis, you didn't want it to be all about the diagnosis and ALS, right. and were able to then turn that to continue to do important, good work. What allowed you to make that switch to the change of focus with such clarity and confidence in a time of, you know,
personal crisis?
Yeah.
Well, sure. I think, well, part of it is that it takes a long time to be diagnosed with ALS. And I remember in my post-bar trip to the beach, my best friend, who is a physical therapist, said, you're favoring that leg. I knew I'd had a little weakness. I figured it was the stress. If you've ever prepped for the bar or your medical boards, I would think there's a sort of holy terror and
sure.
panic before as you're doing that. And I thought, oh, it'll get better. And then she evaled my leg and said, you have whole leg weakness and are hyperreflexive. And I could tell she was scared about it. And we talked about possibilities. And I literally said, you know, the way it's going with my luck, it's going to be ALS. And of course, no, it's too rare. It won't be that. But I think, you know, she said, people know what they have. And as I explored these other things, I was never really surprised to learn that it was not a spinal impingement. It was not MS. It was not these other things. And so many things were ruled out that it wasn't a complete shock to me when it happened. And as I began to think this could be degenerative and terminal, I sort of thought, well, what if it is? And I knew that I did not want, it was like a logic problem in law school almost. If that's the fact of the matter, and there's nothing to be done, and you have a finite amount of time, how are you going to spend it? And I decided, I'm not going to waste any time hurling myself against locked doors. I'm not going to waste time in anger or asking why. There's no answer to that. And I did not want to fall apart, because any time I spent falling apart was time I wouldn't have to spend doing the writing and advocacy and the work that I had hoped to do. So, and also, I guess there's a part of me that's kind of mean-spirited. I didn't want ALS to win.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like by refusing to crumble or stop doing what I had intended to do, I'm sort of refusing to give the disease a victory over me. I think people do that all the time. Yeah, and so then when I went on to do the work promoting the causes, people started to say things like, you're so inspirational. And I really want to insist that I'm not. I'm logical. I'm being pragmatic. I also have to say that I experience what we Christians call the peace that passes understanding. But I think anyone who has a genuine faith in a loving creator and a sense that our spirit goes on beyond this world, if you have that genuine faith, you are able to face your mortality, I think, in a different way. And that's a gift. It's not special courage or strength, I don't think. I think it's a gift that was bestowed upon me. And so, as I was saying, with all of this, I think it's the ideas that I'm talking about, equity, justice, I think those ideas are inspirational. I'm just having this platform that gives me an opportunity to talk about them on shows like this and storytelling and political ads I was able to do for the NEA and speeches I was able to make in Raleigh. So I think it's the ideas that are inspirational.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break, but when we come back, mm-hmm. we're going to delve into the work you've been doing and a chance to hear, celebrate, think, figure out what the next chapters are. We're going to take a short break, but we'll continue with our guest Vivian Connell about adversity, inspiration, and hope. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Vivian Connell, teacher, lawyer, and advocate, about adversity, inspiration, and hope. And Vivian, in the last segment, you shared with us a bit of your story of being a teacher and caring about civil engagement and advocacy, becoming a lawyer, having this diagnosis of ALS and being faced with a terminal illness and redirecting your life to these goals that you have for education and for advocacy. Tell us a little bit about those goals and which are the most important causes to you as you're fighting for justice and equality.
Well, I guess the three targets that I had when I left law school were education policy, although I did not want to be an education lawyer. I had done a lot of consumer protection work. I had become very interested in the fine print in contracts that takes away consumers' rights, also employees and patients, mandatory arbitration, and some other legal things. And I was interested in doing work in that arena. And then the other that I think is sort of at the heart of what I see as an absolute threat to American democracy is the necessity, the imperative for campaign finance reform. This notion of corporations as people and the fact that money influences our democratic process and elections so much. And I wanted to be a part of doing any work I could to reverse that. And I thought that in doing that, we'd be a lot more likely to see racial equity, a change in what is a growing economic disparity between rich and poor. And we'd make a lot of, we'd move toward greater justice more quickly if we were electing public servants and not full-time fundraisers and money raisers as our politicians. So all of those ideas were very dear to me. We ended up with education first because in my Facebook post, I had asked people to perhaps help me take a group of immigrant and economically disadvantaged kids to the Holocaust Museum, and that turned out to be one of the most amazing experiences of my life. It turned from being a shoestring budget up and back into this three-day trip that I don't think any high school students in America have been able to equal. The things that were done for me by museum staff, the special programs, getting to enter the National Archives 2 hours early. The National Archivist, David Ferriero, had read my story and took our kids in to see the actual Nuremberg Laws signed by Hitler that aren't on display, the books that were used in Monuments Men, the art lookbooks, into the rotunda where they had a private viewing of our nation's founding documents. I mean, you don't get that. At the Holocaust Museum, they were taken through the crowd and assisted in tiny groups by docent guides. These are often survivors or people very close to the museum who are generally reserved to help VIPs and heads of state. And so I have to say that sort of set the tone for amazing things. And then I'm doing a national ad promoting education in North Carolina. And then I'm doing a 20-minute story on the Monty and invited to speak at synagogue for Yom HaShoah. I just, one great thing.
And then back in
another.
Washington for the National Mall or the memorial, right?
That was absolutely fabulous, yes. Went to the Capitol for the National Days of Remembrance ceremony. I was invited back this year to the National Tribute Dinner where I met Romeo Dallaire, who was honored with the Elie Wiesel Award last year. He was played by Nick Nolte in Hotel Rwanda. Well, with my students, we focused on genocide prevention. So here was the man who had tried to stand between the Hutus and Tutsis during the Rwandan genocide, and I'm shaking his hand and speaking with him. It was an incredible blessing. And actually, I don't know if you know, but I think I'm going to meet Al Franken, who is a champion of arbitration reform and campaign finance reform, and he has said that he would like to meet with me. I would never have gotten to do that as a lawyer. Do you see what I mean?
Yes.
So I'm just trying to make the most of these opportunities to promote these things that I believe are truly for the greater good.
Can you share the brief story about the generosity that someone in the community made available to your kids to perhaps be able to take back a memory with them, and what the one student who did something unexpected perhaps, and
Absolutely.
How that impact of getting the kids up there fulfilled perhaps one of your objectives fully?
You know, even after we had financed a bare bones trip, people said, no, we want to give more. We want it to be really special. And so a local donor who is a great supporter of the museum, who had introduced me to the director and the chair and made possible my trip to these wonderful ceremonies, he gave a special donation to enable every student to have a credit at the gift shop. And to provide each, he and I talked about this because we both keep our Remember Stone, which you can get, you know, never forget the Holocaust, genocide, remember. We each keep our Remember Stone on our desks. We had exchanged photos. So he made this donation, and the students went in, and these are kids that don't have pocket money for things like this, and they're buying wonderful books and DVDs, and they've had this amazing trip through the museum. And one student came out, an African-American boy, wearing a Star of David. And I said to him, honey, are you not Jewish? And he said, no, no. He said, but I'm never taking this off. And what he explained to me in different words, but he recognized the commonalities, you know, our common humanity. And he also realized that as an African-American male, he wasn't the only minority or the only ethnic or racial group that had been set apart as other and had been a victim of the evil that we do when we separate ourselves from others and then discriminate, persecute, right? And so that happened. Many of the students were absolutely overwhelmed by, none were Jewish, and yet the connection they felt, having been, for example, the Burmese immigrants, having faced persecution because of their ethnicity as Karen, the Hispanic students having faced run-ins with authorities and being treated, their perception, rougher, differently, because they were not documented. And here they saw, this isn't unique to me. This is a problem in our society and one that I need to stand up, confront, speak out against. And if even a few of those are able to do that, I feel that it's going to be like a ripple in a pond, mm-hmm. you know?
Amazing.
I couldn't have been happier.
Thinking of the ripple in the pond, and I hear you say that you don't want it to be about you and your illness, and you're focusing on the gift of your faith and how that has shaped you and what you hope to do in this time that you have. What would you hope would be your legacy? I hear it's not about you, but yet you have a unique perspective.
Word, because I've enjoyed some of these things. I've received real treats going to these places that I wanted to see, meeting people. The wonderful event, the REM benefit for public justice, the public interest law firm that you attended, Adam, right?
Yes.
And these have been blessings, personal blessings to me. But I think that in reading, someone said, legacy is ego, education is faith. Hmm. And so each time I get to talk about the ideals, the importance of supporting public interest law, in all of their issues of civil rights, equity, environmental protection, fiscal morality, about promoting education and the responsibility, the civic responsibility to make sure every child of every color and every background has receives an education that can allow them to achieve their fullest potential as artists, statesmen, businessmen, right? That in saying this, that the truth in the ideas, right, the education that takes place and the inspiration that I hope comes from those ideals will carry on. And I guess that I don't see that as my legacy, but as me being able to take part in the legacy of these great ideas that have been around since Aristotle. I think you remember the quote, right? When Socrates told the Athenian Senate, anyone can avoid death if they're willing to compromise, you know, if they're willing to say or do anything, to sell out, but that the real trick in life is not avoiding death. We're all going to die. I think we know that. But it's avoiding unrighteousness, which runs far faster than death. And each time I say that, people come and they say, that's right. And I say, yes, it is, but I didn't say it. I'm just, I have this chance to remind you.
Well, you're an instrument, is what you are, an instrument of the Lord. You're delivering that in a unique way, and it's beautiful.
I pray that may be so.
So we're going to have to end up, but just real quickly, you're on the tracks. That train is still on the tracks. It's still moving. I can hear it. We can all hear it. Where's it going next?
It's going next to Washington, D.C., where I hope to meet Senator Al Franken and talk to him about what I might be able to do. Perhaps I've been asked to do a TED Talk. An idea of, you know, what I'd like to say before I go, this notion of before I go, and just trying to put into words, into print, all I can, these ideas that I believe really do improve the quality of our society. Any way I can, I will.
Well, we appreciate you allowing us to be on the train with you for a while.
Oh, goodness, thank you.
And wow. We're excited to hear and follow and to participate. And I'm certain we'll put some links up for some things that you're find valuable that others might like to be able to do good and follow in a path of righteousness.
Delighted. That would be an honor. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
We've been talking with Vivian Connell, teacher, lawyer, advocate, woman of faith, about adversity, inspiration, and hope. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we will spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
If you have a question or comment you want to send to us on a coming show, send it to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our executive producer, Erica Norrie, to read us our very first House Call.
I've listened to your show discussing weight loss and how it can help people with high blood pressure. I'm pretty overweight, but recently lost 10 pounds over a 3-month period. My blood pressure did not decrease much. I'm still on blood pressure medications, but I'm hoping to get off them soon. Do you think if I lose more weight, this will happen?
I sure hope so. Boy, we would love to hear about it.
Yeah, we would love to. It is true that some people, and certainly patients who've had gastric bypass surgery, who have lost significant weight through other ways, have been able to come off their blood pressure medicines. It's not always the case. And so with each person, it's individual of how much of it is genetic and how much of it can be related to weight and diet and other things. But losing weight's the right thing to do if you're overweight, and it might allow you to come off your blood pressure medicines.
You know, you're on that train of weight loss, and boy, stay on that train.
Yep.
It's the right one for you. Keep doing what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Congratulations. Let us know. Erica, what's our very next house call?
I used to weigh 180 pounds and could have stood to lose a few more pounds based on my height. Over the last 2 months, I lost 40 pounds without even really trying. While many people say that I look great, I'm really concerned. I feel fine, but I really don't have any appetite. I'm not depressed. Should I see a doctor?
You know, 40 pounds, I mean, a lot of it depends on what your height is. It's hard to know how far overweight 180 pounds was. But 40 pounds in 2 months without trying is kind of significant. So,
I'm not.
Usually people work
hard
for that.
This is like the opposite of that last one.
Yeah, exactly.
Where, you know, you lost 10 pounds over 2 months. Here it's 40 pounds. So that's too much. And particularly if you really aren't depressed and you're not really trying to, or even if you were depressed, I'd be real concerned. I do think you should see your doctor.
I do too. And maybe there are other things. Maybe if you cut out soda, or maybe there have been changes you're not aware of that helped you lose weight. But that does seem like a lot in a short period of time. Go get your thyroid checked and talk to your doctor about other things.
Your blood counts. Mm-hmm. And good luck. We hope for the best and pray for the best, too.
Mm-hmm.
Erica, what's our very next house call?
I bring a list with me to my doctor's appointments so I don't forget anything. During my last visit, I saw a new doctor, and she stopped me after about 10 minutes and said that we only had time to discuss 3 of the issues on my list rather than the 7 or 8 listed. I thought it was rude. What do you think?
Well, that is another tricky one. I think it's very helpful that you bring in the list to talk with your doctor so you don't forget anything. But sometimes it's tricky if one of the things on your list, for example, is something that really requires a lot of investigation, something like I'm tired or I have chest pain, or there are lots of things that may require a full 20-minute appointment just for that one problem. And so it may not be possible to do justice to get through all 8 problems. And there might be other times where you had several little tiny problems that you're able to get through several. So there's not an absolute feeling about that.
What I usually do with that, and I kind of agree with you, Christy, is I'll say, let me see your list.
Yep,
let me acknowledge what all the issues that you want to discuss. And then let's talk about how much time we actually have in the meeting. And then say, if we have 20 minutes or 25 minutes, which ones do you want to discuss? And I think it's fine halfway through that to say, well, you wanted to discuss 5 or 6 of them, but we're halfway through and we've only discussed 1 or 2, and negotiate that and negotiate when to come back. Maybe it appeared rude, or maybe it was rude in how it was said.
Exactly.
But I think the idea of setting a limit and saying this is the time and jointly managing it, I'm in favor of that.
The best way is to try to do that at the beginning, to say to your doctor, here's my list. This is the most important thing today, but if we can, let's get through a lot of them from there.
Thank you for joining us today for Your Health. We'll have to kind of put a bookmark in the conversation, but we hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to you. You can send us your own questions or stories at yourhealth@unc.edu.
And we want to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Vivian Connell. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page, and we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.